Everybody remembers the Mercury 7, the famous first astronauts in America's first space program. John Glenn, Alan Shepard, Scotty Carpenter, Gus Grissom. But how about the Mercury 13? They were women, 13 of them, who in 1960 and 1961 took part in a secret testing program in hopes of becoming America's first female astronauts. They qualified. They might have made it into space if NASA and the president hadn't shut their program down. Now historian Martha Ackman has uncovered their story. She told Ann Strange Champs it began when Randy Lovelace, the man who ran America's astronaut testing program, decided he wanted to test women as well as men. He was wondering how to go about it when he ran into a woman named Jerry Cobb.
Lovelace came across Jerry Cobb in just quite a remarkable situation. They were both walking the beach in Miami Beach in 1960, attending an Air Force conference in Miami. And they began talking, and Lovelace was conversing with Cobb about his desire to find a woman pilot. Jerry Cobb was named Pilot of the Year in 1959. She held three aviation records for altitude and long distance flying. She was well known as the only woman international ferry pilot, that is, ferrying surplus military aircraft from the United States to points all over the world. She was pretty well known and probably the most hotshot woman pilot in 1959 and 60. So he asked her, he said, would you be interested in being our guinea pig and in taking these tests and see how you might perform? She didn't miss a beat. She said, tell me when and where.
How did she come to flying in the first place?
I think it was in her DNA. Her father was in the Army Air Corps and later in the Air Force, and he loved planes. She grew up around planes. She was a shy, taciturn Oklahoma girl, more interested in all things that were active rather than sitting in a classroom. And her father got her into a plane when she was very, very young. She had to sit on pillows. She had her father rig up sort of wooden props so that she could push the rudder pedals.
So what about some of the other women? There were 13 of them who had hopes of becoming astronauts. Where did they come
from? Right. Well, after Cobb went through, she was the guinea pig, and the tests, of course, were secret because no one knew how they might turn out. But after her scores were revealed, and they were so extraordinary, Lovelace asked her to help him select a larger group of women to see if she was a fluke. I should also point out that in 1960 and 61, women pilots, as accomplished as they were, weren't given many opportunities professionally. When I interviewed these women, they told me story after story of, getting the rare job as a charter pilot because the airlines wouldn't hire women, the military wouldn't allow women to fly airplanes. But if they'd get one of those lucky jobs as a charter pilot, they would be sitting in the captain's seat and they'd be flying, corporate executives from one place to another. And when they would get on the intercom and say, this is your captain speaking, and passengers heard a female voice, many demanded to get off the plane. They simply didn't trust women to fly. So many of these women had to work in other occupations while they did their flying whenever they could. So in addition to being these top flight women pilots, they were also a third grade teacher from Akron, Ohio, a woman by the name of Jean Hickson, who broke the sound barrier in the late 1950s and then went back to her third grade class. She was known as the supersonic school marm. There were identical twins from California, Jan and Marion Dietrich. Jan flew professionally most of her life, and Marion worked as a reporter for the Oakland Tribune. One of the most interesting women, I think, they were all interesting, but Janie Hart really attracted some attention because she was the mother of 8 children when she took the test. She was 40 years old. And she was the wife of a U.S. senator, of Senator Phil Hart of Michigan. So these women came from a wide range of backgrounds, and they had to sacrifice a lot.
Once they began undergoing the tests, what sort of tests were these?
At the Lovelace Clinic, they were all medical tests. They were some 75 in all. And when we look back 40 years with our perspective, and some of them seem just outrageously bizarre and odd, invasive and difficult, I think 83 x-rays of everything that could possibly be x-rayed. One test that both the men and the women astronaut candidates told me was particularly awful was they wanted to see how the body would react to sort of wild stages of vertigo, as though a spacecraft was tumbling out of control. So they put the subject in a chair and they injected into the inner ear water right at the point of freezing, right, almost before freezing. And once that ice-cold water hit the inner ear, this whole state of kind of confusing, rolling, nausea-producing wild vertigo set in, and the men and the women grabbed the arms of their chairs, if they could find them, in order to steady themselves, and their eyes oscillated back and forth, left, right, left, right, left, right, very, very quickly. And doctors then tried to determine how long it would take for their eyes to adjust and come back to normal so that they could read and function. And the Lovelace doctors, some of whom are still around and who I interviewed for the book, told me that they noticed that the women didn't complain as much as the men. They didn't grouse as much. I think the women felt that maybe they had more on the line.
The Mercury 7 men were famously a bunch of characters. I mean, maverick, independent, outspoken types. Were the women like that too?
No, not exactly. Women pilots certainly had to be confident and competent, and I think a sense of confidence is certainly something that I saw in all of the women. But 1961, women also had to be ladies in everything that stereotype implies. So, for example, when they were setting world records, world aviation records for altitude, they had enough to worry about pushing planes up as high as they possibly could get them to go. But they also had to worry about how they looked. They flew in Chanel suits and high heels. And when they landed, they had to make sure that their makeup was in place.
That makes you think about the old line about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. You know, Ginger Rogers could do everything Fred Astaire did except backwards and in high heels.
Right, right. That's right. The women did tell me regarding high heels that, you know, they had to climb into these cockpits, up ladders, step into cockpits in high heels, and then they took them and flung them to the back of the plane. They flew barefoot.
Well, tell the story of what happened once, you know, they qualified to become astronauts, but then there was an enormous battle with NASA and even with Congress. What happened?
That's right. When they reached what they called Phase 3 testing, that spaceflight simulation test to see how they would respond to G-loads and other space simulation tests, they needed special equipment. And so Randy Lovelace went to the Navy. What happened was that once more women were scheduled to come to Pensacola, the Navy thought that they needed an official NASA sanction. Now, Randy Lovelace was the head of life sciences for NASA, but a NASA contractor. And so the Navy went to NASA, and the officials in Washington said, you know, we don't really have any interest in this program. We see it as Randy Lovelace's independent experiment. Now, while the U.S. wanted very much to be able to send the first dog into space, the first chimpanzee into space, the first man into space, sending the first woman into space simply wasn't a priority. It was at that point that what had been a scientific question, could women fly, could women perform as well as male astronauts, turned into a political one. Do women have the right to be? So it was at that point then that Jerry Cobb, as the primary figure in this story, began petitioning Congress, and she simply didn't take no for an answer. It's interesting to think that the story could have stopped there, that the women would be disappointed, the tests were canceled, the end. But they pushed it further. And so with Cobb's help and with the help of Janie Hart and her connections in Washington, first a meeting with Vice President Lyndon Johnson was arranged.
And what happened? What did Johnson say?
Johnson was head of the Space Council at that point and very involved with NASA. He met with the women in March of 1962, and the women reported that he listened patiently, he heard what they had to say, and then he sort of threw up his arms and he said, you know, I'd like to help, but it's really in NASA's lap. It's really their call. What they didn't know was that on LBJ's desk was a letter that had been prepared for his signature by one of his staffers. It was a letter to the head of NASA and asked, in a rather non-committal way, is there any reason why women can't be astronauts? Can you fill me in on some of the background of this? LBJ decided not to send that letter and, in fact, wrote at the bottom of it, let's stop this now. He didn't want to see this program go forward.
Why? I mean, was this just sexism, pure and simple, just something about the idea of women in space was revolting to him?
I think that's a large part of it. Some people thought that it was too great a risk to take, that if something should happen to a woman astronaut candidate, it would run the risk of canceling the whole program, that somehow putting a woman in a dangerous position or having a woman even lose her life would cause all of NASA's efforts to crumble.
What did these women go on to do after their dreams of spaceflight were crushed?
Well, they were certainly disappointed, but they took a variety of routes. Jerry Cobb left the United States. She, several years after that congressional hearing, returned to South America, where she had spent so much time ferrying aircraft. And she became a one-woman missionary pilot in the Amazon rainforest, where she remains. She is now in her early 70s, and she rarely comes back to the United States. You can't get in touch with her. She doesn't have a phone or address, and she prefers it that way.
There's a kind of coda you tell to this story. In 1999, Eileen Collins was selected as the first woman to command the space shuttle, and she invited the Mercury 13 women to be there for her first launch. And you went along, too, to witness this kind of historic event. What did you see?
One of the things I saw was there were several delays with the shuttle being launched over, I think, two or three nights was scrapped. And one time it got down to 6 seconds before blastoff, and the clock stopped. There was a technical hitch, and a teenager in the stand slams his fist down on the grandstand and says, T minus 6 seconds. And Jerry Sloan Truhill, who was sitting next to Bea Stedman, one of the other members of the Mercury 13, turned to her with a kind of wink in her eye and said, try T-minus 38 years. When the shuttle finally went off, Jerry Cobb, alone as she so often is, separated from the crowd who were standing on the grandstands, getting higher and higher up in those rows so that they could see the shuttle lift off. And as they were all standing and shouting and screaming, Cobb quietly sat down into the grass and spread her hands out. She wanted to feel the ground rumble.
Martha Ackman is the author of The Mercury 13, the untold story of 13 American women and the dream of spaceflight. Anne Strangeham spoke with her.